Hello, I'm Kevin Moore, and you're now listening to The Moore Show. For the next hour, I'll cover subjects of an alternative variety that most shows do not touch. On today's show, I'm joined by Dr. Nick Begich, where we'll discuss his research into harp, mind effects, and ESP. So stay tuned, enjoy, and I'll be right back.
Mr. Show or a guest? Want to know more about The Moore Show and upcoming guests? Then log on to www.themoreshow.co.uk.
You get a shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime. Sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear. In other places, but the horns they blow in that sound way on down south. Guitar George, he knows all the chords. Mighty strictly rhythm, he doesn't want to make it cry or sing. If any old guitar is all he can afford, when he gets up under the lights, play his thing.
You're listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. We're about to be joined with our guest, Dr. Nick Begich. Well, just a bit of background on Nick. He is well known for his work and research on harp, mind effects, and more. He has widely reported in these areas as an expert for many publications, government organizations, and private companies. He has been an expert witness for the European Parliament on these subjects and provides significant research contributions in this area. Also, through the Lay Institute on Technologies, he organized a private meeting for top scientists in the area of mind effects and ESP back in 2007. Dr. Nick Begich, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Nick, just tell us a bit about yourself first, please.
Yeah, I am an independent researcher here in Alaska, in the United States, and I've been researching science and technology for the last 15 years. I've published five books in eight languages, and primarily on science and technology. Prior to that, I have worked as an administrator within the public school system here in Alaska. I was president of the Alaska Federation of Teachers twice elected the Anchorage Council of Education. I have a doctorate in traditional and complementary medicine. And I come from a highly political family here. My brother's in the U.S. Senate. My father was in the United States Congress. And I've operated as predominantly an activist for the last 15 years on technology-related issues.
Okay, well, it's an honor to have you on the show today. So we're going to discuss quite a few different threads today, from HAARP, ESP, and mind control. So let's start with HAARP, Nick. Tell us about HAARP.
Well, HAARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project based here in Alaska. It was originally set up by the Air Force and Navy and later switched over to DARPA, which does primarily defense-related research in the United States for branches of the military. And essentially, it is a field of antennas, 180 antennas, 72 feet tall, which is approximately 22 meters in height. 180 of these in an array. They broadcast radio frequency energy. And actually, through a method called cyclotron resonance, they're able to focus that energy into a relatively small area for manipulating the magnetic field lines that surround the Earth, as well as the ionosphere, which is an energized layer that begins about 40 kilometers above the Earth's surface, extending for several hundred kilometers out from there. But it's highly charged, and manipulating it or disturbing it in certain ways can have some pretty interesting weapons applications.
Yeah, so, I mean, what is HAARP actually capable of doing then?
Well, there's a number of things. Firstly, the standard stuff that shows up in the military literature on the device is the idea of interfering with communications by disturbing the ionosphere in just the right way. You can essentially knock out most or all of our terrestrial communications, but maintain your own at the same time. So from a weapons perspective, you know, that becomes pretty attractive. The other is over-the-horizon radar, being able to look over the curvature of the Earth utilizing HAARP technology and be able to locate incoming objects all the way from intercontinental ballistic missile heights, very, very high up, down to cruise missile heights, and then being able to discern which of those objects are carrying nuclear payloads, and then perhaps even more importantly, being able to create a surge of energy or a pulse of energy sufficient to knock out the electronics on those incoming craft. So, you know, from that perspective, sort of the ability to observe, discriminate, and then destroy incoming objects is part of that. The other is a little different. By modulating or sending a pulsed high-frequency signal up to the ionosphere, you can pulse the signal in or pump the signal in such a way as the ionosphere begins to respond to that pulse rate. And so what returns to the Earth is an extremely long, an ELF wavelength, extremely low, very long wavelength, low frequency. It penetrates the Earth and sea. This is used for two purposes that are acknowledged in the literature. One is communication with submarines. The second is using it for what's called earth-penetrating tomography, which in simple language by analogy would be similar to like X-raying the Earth or looking into the Earth several kilometers.
Yeah, yeah.
Determine location of tunnels and mineral deposits and so on. But in that frame, this is where one of the more controversial areas emerges. When you're generating ELF signals within certain frequency ranges, they are biologically active. They couple with the human body in such a way as to influence chemical reactions within the body. You can affect emotional states using ELF signals from HAARP. So this becomes important from our perspective. The other area deals with weather modification technologies that sort of grew out of the HAARP science. Initially, when it was first developed, the idea of manipulating weather patterns was discussed, but the power levels were just huge. I mean, significantly greater than what HAARP is today. However, the inventor, 10 years later, developed a new theoretical model that was accepted prior to his death that actually showed that you could manipulate weather with HARP using 1,600 times less energy than you originally expected, which means that the current configuration is more than adequate for manipulation of geophysical systems and weather systems.
Now, HARP, I believe, stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. Was this mainly a military project? What is the history of HARP?
Well, originally they sold it as an academic project, but when the controversy began in the mid-90s, they pulled it out of the academics and moved it over to strictly being run by the Air Force and Navy, then later DARPA. Now, they do use the instrument through a number of universities for different kinds of experiments during the course of the year. So it was considered a developmental prototype, so it's available to other researchers. And, you know, most of this research across the spectrum is well compartmentalized. So you've got a lot of different things going on, and how they all sort of converge, you know, into the HARP project is really what, you know, what a lot of our research has been about over the years.
So, I mean, roughly, how much does it cost to create HARP then?
Well, you know, the cost as military systems go are pretty low. I mean, they've spent maybe $250 million U.S. on this project over the years, which is a drop in the bucket compared to, say a new bomber at over $1 billion.
Yeah.
Dollars. But what folks have to bear in mind is that the array itself is relatively simple, $250 million to build it out. But it's based on over 50 years of radio physics and engineering that if you actually went back and looked at sort of what feeds HARP and what makes HARP possible, you could probably count the basic research in many billions of dollars over that 50-year period.
Right. And what does the actual field of antennas look like?
Well, if you were to look at them, you would see a mass going straight up out of the ground, 72 feet, and then a cross, what's called a cross dipole, which is about 60 feet or approximately 20 meters, that would be perpendicular. So it's like a big cross mounted on the top, and then you're looking at a field of 180 of these, separated a little bit. But it's a pretty large array. Eventually it'll be 360 antennas. When they started, there were 48. So it's almost quadrupled since, say, inception, and it's expected to double from where it is today.
Okay. Now, you're currently based in Alaska, and I do believe that Alaska had one of the first HARP facilities there. But HARP isn't just based in the U.S. I mean, HARPs, other countries have their own HARP systems. Is that right?
Well, they have the same technology by different names. In Europe, it's the IZICAT system, which we referenced in our book a fair amount. And then there's the old Russian transmitters, or the old former Soviet Union's transmitters, of which there were five. China now has one based in towards the Antarctic in that region. And then Canadians also have a system across Canada. Now, the researchers, the people that get involved in this research, are fairly limited. There's only, you know, a few hundred of them in the whole world. And so they tend to cooperate and coordinate projects between the organizations. For instance, NATO France did a paper years ago on ionospheric modification for weapons application. In fact, we used their document to open our testimony in the European Parliament, where we raised and brought this issue to the Security and Disarmament Subcommittee of the Foreign Affairs Committee. In fact, it was Tom Spencer from Great Britain who was chairing the Foreign Affairs Committee at the time that was able to organize a couple of visits for us into Europe to present our data to parliamentarians and to build a coalition between conservatives, Greens, and Social Democrats, which we successfully did. And then in 1999, the Parliament actually passed, European Parliament passed a resolution, part of the biggest security and disarmament resolution they've ever passed, which included four sections dealing with HARP and one section dealing with some of the more exotic weapons that we had discussed in our testimony.
Sure. And I've heard, you know, sort of out there, that the actual technology that HAARP's based on was, you know, something that the scientific genius Nikola Tesla is believed to have worked on.
Right.
You know, he was using these sort of oscillating fields to, you know, release high amounts of energy. You know,
right.
Is it true then that some of the HAARP technology is embedded with the Tesla technology?
It is, actually. In fact, if you go back to the original patents by Dr. Eastland, and I knew Dr. Eastland very well, and he attended one of our conferences when I was working with the Lay Institute on Technology. I had plenty of opportunities to speak with him. You know, and Tesla was referenced in his original patents. If you look at those patents, you'll see them in the reference section. And the inspiration, I suppose, you could say, came from Tesla. The system was probably quite different, but the idea was the same, was to create this weapons technology using energy as its base. So it's not the standard bombs and bullets, but something you can't even see having effect on all of these systems.
Do you think it's possible that we've already seen other countries, like Norway, for example, using their own HAARP technology, as in the sort of corkscrew light effect that we saw over Norway a year ago?
Yeah, actually, in northern Norway at Tromsø, there is a transmitter that's run by the Max Planck Institute from Germany that actually has a phased array. In fact, at one time, back before HAARP in Alaska was built, they had actually tested it where they oscillated a high-frequency signal up into the ionosphere and got the ionosphere to vibrate to Wagner, which is pretty bizarre, but they did it. In terms of what you would expect to see, firstly, you would need a rocket launch, which is interesting that kind of mixes into the Norway story. Because in order to get that kind of visual effect, ideally you'd want to dissipate very fine particulate material. Here in Alaska, they used barium, and from the Poker Flats rocket range, launched a rocket, and then got this. And the idea was to light up the energy areas that were being affected by HAARP and the magnetic field lines of the Earth. And so in that case, what they got was this line. That was the magnetic field line of the Earth, and then around it was this corkscrewing bit of energy that lit up when they launched the barium. And so it's possible that a rocket launch was involved, but I agree with your suggestion that very probably it was either the transmitter at Tromsø or perhaps one of the transmitters located in what's now Russia. But I think the visual effect of what was seen certainly lines up with what one would expect under certain applications of HAARP or systems like HAARP.
Sure. And with weather, you've mentioned weather modification with the HAARP system. Was that one of the original ideas,
right,
then, the weather modification?
Yeah, it was, actually. In fact, we found some of the original documents. In fact, we cite in our book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, over 350 sources, including the original patents. And that's where that came from. And it also came out of the planning documents when the military brought together all of the various people. There were over 80 civilians and military people brought together to look at setting the perimeters before they went to bid and before they developed the contract document to build HAARP. And they spoke very clearly about the weather modification applications. The problem at the time was the power levels were thought to be needed were the actual energy requirements were relatively low. What Eastland determined was that you could manipulate with relatively low energy gravitational waves, which might allow you to manipulate not only weather fronts, but also perhaps other geophysical properties of the Earth. In other words, to destabilize things, you could perhaps create earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. In fact, I'll read a quote, if I may.
It's sure.
The one-liner, but it comes from Secretary of Defense William Cohen when he was Secretary of Defense, and he was commenting on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. This is from April 28th, 1997, so it's before 9/11, and it's from a DOD DOD news briefing, and it's quoted actually in one of our books, Earthrising the Revolution, and it says, and I quote, "Others are engaging even an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. Now, that's pretty amazing to hear that kind of attribution to terrorists being able to create earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, climate changes with electromagnetic waves back in 1997, 13 years ago. What we do know is the technology has probably been around a very long time, going back at least to the 70s, when there was a treaty signed by the United States and 60 other countries, and a dialogue led by the Soviets to not use environmental manipulation as a weapon of war. Rumsfeld, when he was in a position of power, was suggesting that we abandon that treaty because our technology had advanced so much in the recent years. And so, you know, not just HART, but many systems, several systems, have been designed to affect weather and to be able to literally affect the geophysics of the planet. And that's why we consider this such an important issue. I mean, when you think about the planet itself already demonstrating instabilities, which we've all witnessed in numerous ways, experiments in this area of a classified nature we think are counterproductive. From the idea of waging covert war and having plausible deniability, we can understand why governments are interested in this technology, but it is extraordinarily risky business and should be reconsidered from our perspective.
So, in your opinion, then, the military could use this technology, this HARP technologies, against other countries as a more sort of covert way, in a sense, rather than using sort of, you know, nukes or, you know, military invasion. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's correct, because then you don't have to wage war, which is obviously controversial. In fact, after the disaster, you might even be invited in to help clean up the mess. So, you know, it's a very different type of technology, but it is, in fact, a technology that has evolved and continues, and this is the main point, continues to evolve at an accelerated rate. And again, you know, like recent earthquakes that we've seen in Haiti and in China, people have asserted, and even some governments have asserted, that they were man-made. And the problem now is it's possible to do these things, and consequently, every time there's an event, it becomes suspect. Even if it were natural, it could trigger huge conflicts down the line. So again, this type of technology needs wider discussion, and it also needs a different kind of dialogue.
And just briefly for the listeners, I mean, how would HARP produce an earthquake?
Well, the idea was that you would use an ELF signal, extremely low frequency signal, that you would, where energy was normally perhaps built up along a fault system, that you could resonate a signal in that would cause that energy to be released. So it's not so much the energy, you know, on the ground, it's more like the primer on a bullet. It's releasing the larger amount of energy that's naturally pent up within the Earth. And so the idea was that you could oscillate a signal in that would trigger that instability and cause that quake to occur in a more controlled and timed and directed way. And so that's, you know, that's kind of the mechanism that's envisioned behind that.
Okay. I mean, what about the light show that some earthquakes have shown? I mean, for example, in, I think it was China, there was some sort of light occurrence that happened, and could this be related to HARP?
It could be. However, in great quakes and large quakes, ionospheric disturbances that result in light shows, literally, are not uncommon. In fact, when you consider that the Earth, in some cases, piezoelectric components, when they start to rupture, it creates a sparking kind of effect. And so often you'll see electrical discharges associated with this and ionospheric discharges. And the ionosphere is responsible for things like the aurora, in terms of how things interact with the ionosphere and how charged particles enter the Earth and interact. So you get these lighting effects above the zones of great quakes. We had them here. They were observed in the early 1960s when we had the Great Alaskan Earthquake, which is one of the first observations of these light effects by scientists and recognized. But remember, that quake lasted for 5 minutes, and so there was plenty of time to make some observations. And I laugh about it because as a young kid, I experienced that quake, and believe me, there's very few people have experienced anything as strong as that. It was over a 9 on the Richter scale, which is considered one of the biggest in the world ever in modern history. But these things do happen. At the same time, artificial methods for triggering those kinds of light shows is also possible, and whether or not they would be associated with a man-made earthquake or not, there's just not enough data to make that clear conclusion at the moment. Again, I'd emphasize that all of these things are now suspect because the technology is here. So more careful review and I think more open discussion of the science. I mean, in the area of weather modification, as an example, Ben Eastland developed new theoretical models, and he would not give them to the military. His view was that they would be the kinds of things that needed to be done, if ever done, and he emphasized the if ever done, in the open light of day with other countries engaged in the research and moving it extremely slowly, because it's like, from a real view, we know so little, and yet we think we know so much. When you start manipulating the entire geophysics of the planet, you better do it in the open light of day if you're going to do it at all. And it better be with the cooperation of everyone else who has an interest in this planet, which is not just the United States.
Sure. I mean, what about some of the positive aspects of HARP? I understand that it's possible to create ozone with HARP as well. And also, there was talk about how it was going to be used to destroy pollutants in the atmosphere.
Right. And this shows up in the original patents. And what I expect will happen at some point, as controversies continue to be raised about HARP, there'll be an announcement that, hey, we've got this great opportunity to clean the air. It's almost like a big ionizer, where you can literally create reactions to create ozone, which if ozone depletion truly is the mechanism behind climate change, then that would be useful. Also, the idea that you can knock out specific pollutants and particulates, that becomes important, again, when we start to consider the state of affairs internationally now in terms of smokestack pollutants, primarily in the developing world, which just don't enjoy the higher standards of environmental protections as Europe or the U.S. or Canada or Australia. So I think when we start to look forward, those possibilities become, I think, worthy of some research and some analysis, again, with private side and public involvement.
Well, we've talked as well about using HARP for weather modification. Haven't the Chinese, though, openly admitted to using weather control?
Oh, yeah, and so have the Russians, and so has a number of private companies. I mean, there's no question that the technology is here, and there's several ways to do it. I mean, you don't need necessarily a HARP system to do it. The Russians were using electrostatics. China was using at least cloud seeding in some instances, and other technologies probably more in line with what the U.S. and Russians have been doing. In fact, there was a great Chinese military journal article that was released by our Central Intelligence Agency a number of years ago that shows an absolute parallel, not just in these weapons advances, but also those that have a more profound effect on humans, aside from these kinds of effects. So the Chinese are certainly advancing rapidly. In fact, what I would suggest to the world is we underestimate the Chinese in this sense. We think $60 billion a year, which is approximate what we think the Chinese spend on military, is a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's 10% of what the U.S. spends on military. But here's the difference. When you are a military contractor in the U.S., your wages and benefits and all of your costs of production far exceed China. In fact, I would venture a bet that what you get in China in actual output in terms of hardware is significantly greater than what we get out of the U.S. for 10 times more money. Because in the U.S., predominant production is tied up in labor, amounting to about 70% of the total cost. In China, it's the materials that represent the greater cost. So you end up building out a whole lot more hardware. Commodities are the same everywhere, but the labor side, the Chinese just beat the heck out of the rest of the world. And so what they've built is the most modern factories with the lowest cost of production, and then they've built out a military establishment that eventually will be able to transport their standing army anywhere in the world they want to go.
Okay, Nick, we're going to take a break there, so stay tuned and we'll be right back.
To connect with the show, email kevin@themoreshow.co.uk. Listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. I'm currently joined here with our guest, Dr. Nick Begich. Nick, we've discussed HARP in general, but how does HARP affect the human mind?
Well, that's an important point. Is you can actually look at a lot of different research, and we quote in the book, in all of our books, there's just hundreds and hundreds of scientific papers and military records quoted. In this area, it's emotional effect. In fact, you can go back to the work of J.F. Gordon MacDonald when he was at UCLA and a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson. He actually talked about electronically stroking the ionosphere in just the right way. You could return a signal that would manipulate the behavior of people over huge geographic areas. In 1969, when he published that information, technology didn't exist to do that. HARP provides the ideal vehicle for accomplishing that. very easy to do in terms of emotional state. Even Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book Between Two Ages, which he published when he was at Columbia University in the early 70s, talked about the same kind of technology being advanced and the implications of it. That was before Brzezinski became National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter. But these, these technologies reach back a long way. HARP just happens to be the most versatile system that could actually deliver on a very large scale on that promise. There are other technologies, however, that become even more important from my perspective. But just going back to the mind control, issue or mind effects issue, on our website we've got hundreds and hundreds of pages of data that's available to people for free on that issue. But within the context of the European Parliament's resolution, we actually demonstrated some technology that convinced the European Parliament the technology was real. And in their resolution A4-0005/99, which included the sections on HARP, they also included under Section 27 the following, and it's a one-line quote, and it reads, and I quote, calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings. Now, to get the European Parliament to take that on in the context of that resolution required us presenting a substantial amount of evidence, and not only evidence, but actually a working device that we could show that could transfer sound directly through the nervous system in a way that had only been mentioned in literature but never demonstrated, as far as I know, to a political body. But that basically cinched it, and it became part of that major security and disarmament resolution. The other place it shows up, the mind control or mind effects, is in a very important article published by the U.S. Army War College in their quarterly called Perimeters back in 1998. They published a significant article called The Mind Has No Firewalls. And within that article was an extremely important statement, and I'll read it. It's a one-liner again. It says, and I quote, a psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This signal would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal. Now, what does that mean, basically? What they're saying in that quote and in that article is basically any electromagnetic carrier, doesn't matter what it is, can be modulated in such a way as to couple with the human system in a way that overrides it and can manipulate it. And so, as an example, the Air Force contracted the University of Utah to look at radio frequency energy's effect on the human body and develop what's called a dosimetry handbook or a dosage handbook. How much radio frequency can the body, accept and handle without overloading? And then they figured out the overloading thresholds for every vital organ in the body, kidneys, liver, lungs, heart, so they could literally interfere with their function at a distance. The same was true with the human mind. In fact, huge amounts of money has been spent by our government in this area, not just looking at sort of the sinister side of how do you control the mind or manipulate the mind and for what purposes, but also in the course of that, they discovered sort of these anomalous, what they call anomalous human potentials, what we used to call extrasensory perceptions or in the realm of what was once called paraphysics. Back in the 70s is the way the military referred to that whole area. So there's really two or three sides to this. One is, from the military perspective, the control mechanism. The second is the idea of enhancing perhaps these extrasensory potentials.
So are you concerned that the human mind is going to be used and abused like from the movie The Manchurian Candidate, for example?
Well, I am. I am concerned. In fact, I consider it the most important issue that I've dealt with. We have, as I said on our website at EarthPulse, we have a lot of material, on the subject. But when I was working as the executive director of the Lay Institute in Dallas, we brought together a group of scientists, which included just top people. In fact, even Ben Eastland attended. And it was a closed conference dealing with the mind effects issue. And Eastland had actually approached Tony Tether, the head of DARPA, and asked him about mind control, mind effects, in advance of this conference. And what Ben told me was no one's laughing anymore. In fact, DARPA has a number of initiatives in this area. The Navy has initiatives in this area. Air Force has initiatives in this area, among others. And the amount of effort and energy is huge. In fact, even The Economist in 2002, in the May 25th issue of 2002, had a cover story called Mind Control. In fact, it is the cover of that issue. And it was dealing with the whole ethics of this. The article dealt with just a short article dealing with just the ethical consequences of manipulating human behavior. And I think that is, again, why the European Parliament acted, was they recognized fundamentally this should be a problem for any civil population. There are certain weapon systems that we have to say should not be developed. Controlling people's mental processes without their consent is one of them. The United States has a long history of non-consensual human experimentation both in the United States and outside of the United States. In fact, it was Secretary of Energy O'Leary during the Clinton administration that admitted 500,000 American victims of human experiments, everything from the things we're talking about today to many other exotic technologies were tested without their fully informed consent. We also did this overseas when we had the opportunity. And in one instance in Canada, one of the big psychiatric institutes was sued because of their collaboration with the Central Intelligence Agency and the effect on over 70 Canadian citizens that were acknowledged, and there were probably many, many more that had never been acknowledged. But these are the problems. In Western society, we expect higher standards than that. When these standards were demonstrated in Germany during the war, at Nuremberg, we hung people for the very same offenses. And here in the United States, no one has been held accountable for 500,000 victims that our own government acknowledges. That's problematic and is indicative of why this kind of science needs to be brought out to the public in a way that we can properly debate and make sure that the penalties for misuse are as severe as any other criminal penalties within civil society.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, do you think then that the idea of the Manchurian candidate existed as even, well, could exist, shall I say, even as a political figure or national figure?
Yeah, that could happen. But you can also go back to the work of Estabrooks at Harvard University in the 1920s, where he didn't call it a Manchurian candidate, he called it a super spy, where you could reprogram someone over a period of time to the point where they had two separate personalities embedded within one. One would have full knowledge of the other, but the other would have no knowledge of the one. And so Estabrooks' work became classified in 1935, 36, somewhere right in there. And then by the mid-60s, he was quite advanced in age. He had published a couple of books on mind effects, and in particular, he had made the statement that he actually created the super spy on several instances and acknowledged it. And that work was probably done in the 1950s and 1960s based on his publications and when they came out, when those statements came out. We looked at his work in the book Controlling the Human Mind. Manchurian candidate as a concept is very real. The problem is when you split a personality like that, you can't put them back together again. I mean, it's probably as evil as things get when you start manipulating people in this way for national interest rather than recognizing the sovereignty of a human being and the sovereignty of a human spirit. From my perspective, this is where the violation occurs. You know, in most religious traditions, because we're talking ultimately about free will here, in most religious traditions, even God doesn't interfere with free will. And here we have technologies in this century and in the past decades that are doing exactly that.
So you do believe then that, for example, the CIA, obviously the CIA had an interest in mind control, but do you think they followed that interest? Did they actually get any further with that?
Oh, absolutely. They work through a number of front organizations, including a Mankind Research Unlimited, which we reference. A guy named Schleicher used to run it. He was a Navy guy. His Northwest Field Director I know personally. And what they did for the CIA and other agencies is they basically engage in a bunch of projects. Nobody understood they were connected back into that agency and into the military establishment, but they were. And even Estabrook's work, he did a lot of work with LSD. In fact, he published that LSD was this great therapeutic drug for certain psychoses in the 1960s, something that anybody in their right mind today would say is ridiculous. But that was his position, and that was the same time that the CIA was using LSD on American servicemen and women, 8,000 of them, as a matter of fact, in a number of tests. In fact, it was revealed in a presidential report to the Congress by the Commission to Investigate the CIA. We cite that work. That's a presidential report and a congressional report that eventually led and was sort of after the Church Committee hearings, where the whole area of mind control was looked at the Central Intelligence Agency, and the person responsible, a guy named Gottlieb, had shredded most of the documents, and so we never really got the full story of what CIA was doing beyond the chemicals until recent years, when they looked at the accounting records, which weren't shredded, and people started to look at what hardware they were using and recognize that it wasn't just chemicals, but there were many other technologies being experimented with at that time.
So how does HARP and mind control sort of fit in together? I mean, and do they connect?
They do. HARP has the ability, in fact, you can look at Persinger's research at Laurentian University with magnetic fields surrounding the brain to create a number of effects. He also wrote a paper in the mid-90s where he said if you could create a complex signal and broadcast it over a large area, you could create a sense of fear or dis-ease or discomfort or anxiety across most of the population. And then you could do something as simple as run a news story in the evening blaming some political group or ethnic group or some foreign adversary for all of your ills, and a certain amount of that energy would divert, would be displaced in that direction. As simple as that could be used. HARP can affect emotional states, and then you can capitalize on that. Now, the other very, very important point here that I want to make is higher states of consciousness, the things that allow us to find that zone in the art of whatever we do, to find that intellectual place where everything just hums along, to get into those higher states of consciousness or even deeper meditative states, requires the absence of fear and anxiety. Because if you look at an EEG, if you look at brain activity when you're experiencing fear and anxiety, you get very incoherent brain patterns, the kind that don't lend themselves to higher ordered thinking or to these anomalous human capabilities. You need slower, rhythmic brain activity, and that you cannot have simultaneously while you're experiencing fear and anxiety. And so you look across the population. It's the greatest way to keep people from reaching their highest potentials is keep them in a state of fear. Look at the institutions that do that, from advertisers to governments to religious organizations to individuals and others. Fear is, in fact, the adversary of the intellect and the adversary of higher consciousness. We have to get past that, recognize these technologies, and don't let them overwhelm us. I mean, the human being has... The big discovery is, you know, not so much about what the military can do or intelligence agencies can do, but what they discovered is about what you and I can do, what each individual person on this planet is endowed with in terms of capacity, if we could get to it, if we could reach it. And some individuals from time to time do. The idea that the whole population has that potential, that's got to be the scariest thing from a military planning perspective, because fully actualized human beings across populations would create a revolution that was so spontaneous and overwhelming, everything would change. And ultimately, it's going to be about that. It's going to be about individuals waking up to our own potentials and acting on what we believe to be right and true. It doesn't mean it will be necessarily the issues we've discussed today. In fact, if getting involved in these issues presents anxiety and fear, I would suggest it's not the issue for you. But each of us have issues, have things we're concerned about that we believe in, and we need to begin to assert ourselves in that direction of change, and then things will change.
No, I totally agree with you there, Nick. And you've not just worked in the mind control field neither. I mean, you researched it, shall I say. What about your work with ESP, extrasensory perception? What direction has that took you in?
Well, this is interesting, and actually I go back to when I was a pretty young kid, and I had a very high interest in this area, and it was back in the 70s when there was a lot published, and there was Ostrander and Schroeder were writing their books on, psychic discoveries behind the Iron Curtain, super learning, a bunch of books were out at the time, and that, as a young person caught my interest, didn't think a whole lot about it until later in life. And as I look at that issue, and when we put together our conference, we brought Alexander Kavaranen, who was the top, he ran the biophysics lab for the USSR Academy of Sciences for the last 10 years there was a USSR, one of the brightest biophysicists in the world. We brought him there, Elizabeth Rauscher, another top flight physicist, many people know who she is, Garth Nicholson, who was a full professor of medicine at the University of Texas, educated over 1,000 MDs, was in attendance. Ben Eastland, who invented the HARP system, was in attendance. Anu Mikaela, who is a biophysicist from Helsinki, and her husband were in attendance. But all of these folks had one thing that surprised me. Even Rosalie Bertel, who is a mathematician at Berkeley at one point and lead one of the top leaders in radiological victims across the planet. And Rosalie's presentation in our closed conference was the next evolution of man. And she's also a nun. I forget which order she's from, but here's a double PhD, used to teach at Berkeley, who's also has a religious background. And her statement was the next evolution of human beings is this awakening of our extrasensory perceptions. Everyone in that room did not disagree. In fact, each of them had their own story of why this was of interest to them. And then Alex presented a paper. It was not published, and it was not available for his video of his presentation. It was not available to the public. The rest are online. You can see them on our website, and they're free. But what he did is the mathematics. He gave us a mathematical model to explain how telepathy works, how telekinesis works, how apparitions appear, etc. Those theoretical models, mathematical models, become useful if you can translate them into engineering and applied engineering against the physics. And I believe that's going to happen. And when it does, it will create sort of the artificial mechanism of getting to where human beings, I think, are destined to go. I think the next evolution is, in fact, the awakening of these suppressed potentials.
And could this be used for military purposes to maybe manipulate human behavior?
Oh, absolutely. That's what's going on right now on the military side of the equation. And my belief is, without the hardware, we have the capability of reaching these same potentials and perhaps even greater potentials than what hardware can produce. But that is exactly right. The idea that man is approaching this technology from the standpoint of manipulation, not from the standpoint of enlightenment, that's a problem. Military planners, accuse many of being paranoid thinkers, but actually that is their job as militaries. Militaries plan for every possibility and then develop plans to deal with them. That's developed some pretty paranoid thinking, believe me. But in saying that, that's why in Great Britain and the United States and other places, we have civilians that actually decide when the military is used and when they're not. And it's because our civil society has a much different view of when we bring out our hammer. But when we talk about these technologies, civil society has not had the opportunity to debate and regulate and control the direction of the science. We think that has to happen, and it has to happen more now than ever because of how fast the science is currently advancing. which we go.
So in your opinion, Nick, you know, how dangerous could heart be?
I think it's one of the most dangerous systems on the planet, just because of the fact that, you know, you can manipulate geophysical systems. I don't think that should be permitted at all. The fact that systems like this, either as a side effect or deliberate effect, can have a biological effect. We need to revise our exposures to radio frequency and other forms of energy. The Russians, as an example, or the Soviets way back then, their standards were 1,000 times more stringent in terms of exposures than in the U.S. Not that they enforced their standards, but the fact that they even recognized the biological effect of very, very low energy, non-ionizing energy sources is very important, because more and more people recognize the biological effect of non-ionizing radiation, low energy, but very unique. You can think about what's being learned as almost the same as whether you're affecting the mind or some organ of the body, or even down to a chemical or cell structure within the body. It's all about hitting the right frequency. And it's almost like dialing through a radio. When you get a resonance effect between the transmitter and the receiver, you get a nice clear signal. The same is true in the human body. When you send energy in the right form, in the right way, you can override natural systems and actually gain control over them. That's the science. I mean, that's the basics of all of this science. And then, you know, it just gets more levels of resolution as technology advances. So the ability to do more and more is now accelerating, just because we have this merger of science and the acceleration of computing skills and micro technologies, nanotechnologies, micro machines, and the like that are converging to give us even higher capability and a better understanding of these natural complex systems.
Nick, what's your website so listeners can get in contact with yourself?
Sure, it's earthpulse.com, and that's EARTHPULSE, earthpulse.com.
Well, Dr. Nick Begich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure. My best to all of your listeners throughout the world and in Europe.
Thank you very much, Nick. Well, if you'd like to find out more on Dr. Nick Begich, go to my site, which is www.themoreshow.co.uk, and look up Dr. Nick Begich under Past Guests. Well, until next time, be safe.